Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Ralph Pointer and Denny Rancourt are my guests. I'm going to begin with Ralph. Ralph is Lynn Stewart's husband. Go to the LynnStewart.org website. I'm on the site now. You'll see three images. The one I like best is on top. That's the Lynn we all know and love. The one on the right says, sign the petition. Regular listeners to this program know Lynn has been gravely mistreated, and that's that, let me say, is an understatement, a gross understatement. The petition, well, you know where Lynn is. She's been wrongfully imprisoned. She's been there for 3.5 months. If she doesn't get compassionate release reinstated after the prison warden granted it to her and it was taken away by the Bureau of Prisons on behalf of the Obama administration, you can be sure of that, and the Attorney General and the whole shebang, that whole criminal gang that's running the country, you can bet that Lynn never would have been put there in the first place, because a legitimate president never would have gone along with what Bush did. Obama's not a legitimate president. Well, there's a petition circulating. Lynn hasn't given up. You'll see an image on the left, the lower left. You'll see Lynn in prison garb. You'll see her head partly covered. You'll see her hair gone. Well, that's what chemo does. Lynn's in stage 4 cancer. It's very serious business. If she doesn't get the kind of treatment she needs on the outside at a hospital that will give it to her, like back home in New York, Sloan Kettering, heaven knows what you'll end up with prison care. It's abominable. That's an understatement. They don't want to give people good care. They don't give a damn about people. That's why they put them in prison in the first place. Ralph, welcome. You can explain this much better than I am, than I can. You've been through this. You've gone through it. Lynn is suffering. You're suffering. A lot of Lynn's friends are suffering along with you both, and you know we support you. Jump in and take over, and in your words, tell listeners what's going on.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on and giving me this opportunity to tell it the way it is. This government wants Lynn Stewart dead. Now, we will go back, as you had mentioned, under the Clinton administration, Janet Reno, the head of the Criminal Division of Prosecution, knew they were taping everything and watching everything that Lynn had done. And they agreed that it was not a crime. As a matter of fact, for the first trial they had for Lynn under George W. Bush and Ashcroft, who came to the World Trade Center to announce they had arrested the Brooklyn grandmother for terrorism, Janet Reno wrote that we knew all about it. It was no crime. And but of course, we know what happened under Bush, the Patriot Act, and this whole push to go to war. And they continued, with this process. But with Lynn, they wanted her dead because in defending the blind sheik, while cross-examining Emot Salem, she found that there was a space in the tapes. And in her bid to have all of the tapes thrown out, because you can't, if you're taping someone, and this Emot Salem was creating the plot, if you're taping someone, you can't leave out the ones you don't want to have. And when Lynn questioned him about the ones that he had left out, why there was a space, as it turned out, he was taping the FBI, and the FBI didn't know he was taping them. And with the follow-up on those questions, and Lynn had said to him, or he said to Lynn, when I told the FBI that the materials that they had given the supposed bombers of World Trade Center 1, that they were going to explode, Emot Salem's were, they told me to shut up. Lynn asked him to repeat, and he repeated it. They told me to shut up, and Lynn repeated it. They told you to shut up. Then the judge cut her off, Judge Mukasey. This is the before he ex-Attorney General of the United States under Bush, who felt that waterboarding was not torture. This was the gentleman I'm talking about. And when Lynn Stewart was convicted of terrorism through a press release, it was issued through Reuters, one of the largest international press corporations in the world, she received a 28-month sentence. But after the 28-month sentence, while she was serving it, the Second Circuit insisted she go back, and because she had not received enough time, they said she felt no remorse, so they increased the sentence to 120 months. Now, before she went in, she was due, that is going to prison, she was due for an operation in New York. And the Second Circuit insisted that she go to jail immediately and not wait to have the operation. They said that she could have the operation in prison. And the facts are that it took 18 months while she was in prison to have the operation. The attending physician said it was the worst case he'd ever seen due to the delay. Then, after she had an operation that was successful, the cancer that was in remission came back. Now she has cancer. It has come back with a vengeance. But one of the problems is it was 4 months after it was discovered before she got treatment. Well, she had a very serious type of breast cancer. It had metastasized, and she is dying. And due to the delay... Now, after we applied for compassionate release, after Lynn had applied, she wrote the letter herself for compassionate release. She was given compassionate release by the warden at Fort Worth Federal Prison after evaluating what the doctors had concluded. And then it sat on the desk at the federal level, or at the level in Washington, D.C. It's a federal prison. It's all federal. But the head of the federal prisons, the warden there, I let it sit for 8 weeks. And when pressured, it was answered, they turned Lynn down. And they turned it down on a pack of lies. And Lynn, Monday morning, while we were setting up in Washington, D.C., in front of the White House, I'm going to be there on a vigil until Lynn is freed or until she comes home in a box. Lynn had called to say that the compassionate release was turned down. And when we asked for the letter that was written, the Bureau of to turn her down, the letter of rejection, it was three paragraphs. The Bureau of Prisons sent the letter that was illegible. In this day and age of print, they sent a letter that was illegible, not legible, and when the lawyer asked for another copy that could be read, they said, go to the Freedom of Information Act and start all over again. We don't have a copy. And Lynn Stewart sent the copy that was given to her Monday by snail mail. Then it goes through the prison mail. We have not yet received that, because the moment we do, we're going to put the answer to the rejection letter on the website so everybody can see the letter and Lynn's answer. And she explains why they lied. They said she's improving. Well, Lynn still is in a quarantine because her white blood cells are too low for her to be in population. They said that she is getting better. Well, if she's getting better, why is she in quarantine? They said that she can fend for herself. Well, that's another lie. She does nothing for herself. Anyone who's been in prison knows that you have to make the bed, clean the floor, go to get your lunch, go to get your commissary. Lynn does none of that. Someone cleans her bed, someone cleans the floor, someone gets her food, and this is, you know, a part of the lie. They didn't bother talking about all the other ailments that Lynn had. She has high blood pressure, she has diabetes, the whole nine yards. So the fact that when the lawyers asked for Lynn for the paper that showed what the prison answer was, they said, go to the Freedom of Information Act to get the paper. And they sent this letter that you can hardly read. And so I figured this isn't even worth going over. You mean that you can't send a legible letter of refusal? They want to keep her longer, and every day that she's there, she becomes closer to death. That gives the cancer a chance to spread. Now, as our daughter, the doctor, said when she first learned of the type of cancer Lynn had, she says it's a very invasive type, and you got to get to it quick. And I repeat, it was 4 months after they discovered the cancer that the reoccurrence of the cancer that was in remission before Lynn got a treatment. And now it is shown that the treatments, the chemo that she's getting, hasn't changed anything to the cancer in her lungs. It hasn't done anything to the cancer in her bones. It hasn't done anything for the cancer in her shoulders. She's dying. And so they just says, well, we think she's okay. And they again said, we think she has 18 to 24 months to live. Well, this is what they said 6 months ago. And so before we started this. And so we would like to get Lynn Stewart back to New York, surrounded by her friends, her family, decent food and food, and above all, care, health care, medical care that cannot be given in a prison. In the prison, when she goes for medical care, she's shackled. We know that story, wasting feet to go. She's shackled to her bed, not conducive to medical care. And in Lynn's own words, medical care in prison is an oxymoron. It does not exist.
And Rob, I got to say one thing. To do this to any human being, even the most outrageous serial killer, a person absolutely deserving of whatever prison punishment they got, to do this to anybody is the most obscene expression of cruel and unusual punishment. It shows America's contempt for rule of law principles, contempt for life, contempt for everything decent people should stand for. To do it to somebody like Lynn, who deserves extraordinary praise for a lifetime of human rights activism for others, for literally doing for others what they never would have, what they never would have gotten without somebody like Lynn stepping up to the plate and doing it for them. To do this to someone like Lynn really shows the true face of a very, very ugly country, a very ugly system. The people running it are criminals. The decent people like Lynn are on the inside, and the criminals committing the crimes are on the outside, free to commit more of them. This is the state of America today. This is what I hammer on all the time. This is what I try to get people upset about enough to want to do something about it to change things. Because if ordinary people just don't get off their rear ends and decide they're not going to take this anymore, it's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And what do they say when there simply is no more freedom? When the Constitution's officially annulled, when martial law is declared, then what happened in Boston for a couple of days happens nationwide, and it's not just for a couple of days. It's a permanent state of emergency where all rights are suspended, where the police can come by. They can roust you up on the street at gunpoint for any reason, for no reason at all. If you don't comply, they can shoot you dead in your tracks, and that's exactly what they'll do. And I think what they're doing to Lynn is an example of what's coming in America full-blown, what everybody will face if they don't do something. And this is what I fear the most, and this is what I try to get people upset and angry and fearful enough to want to do something in their own self-defense. Ralph, I didn't want to interrupt, but sometimes I just got to say some things like that. Let me let you just finish up with more of what you can say about Lynn, because Lynn really is a poster person for the wrongs that America is committing, not just about her, not just about America. It's going on a global basis. There are countless tens of millions of people that are harmed. Millions have been killed. Millions more have been injured. Millions more have been displaced. Hundreds, maybe hundreds of millions of people suffer horrendously, mostly because of U.S. policy. And Lynn is an example of what's done to her that literally is done on such a greater scale to so many people, and nothing is done to stop this.
Well, we must remember, and I always look to say, as you were saying, you're trying to wake people up, but it becomes our fault. We become people who say words without meaning. Lynn Stewart defended those who defended the rest of us. And when I talk about that, those noble declarations, and it went in the course of events, and you know the rest of the words, people must defend themselves, have a right to defend themselves against the government. Then if you defend yourself against the government, you need an attorney. So what they're doing is putting the attorneys in jail, because Lynn Stewart did defend those who defended us. She defended political prisoners. She defended people like the Larry Davis in New York who shot six police in self-defense, and the mayor said there's no self-defense for against the police. Well, there is self-defense against the police, and Lynn Stewart approved it. They never forgave her for all of her good works for the people, because they do not intend for the poor and oppressed to ever have representation politically or legally. And this is who Lynn Stewart is, and they shut the lawyers down. And we must remember that many lawyers made press releases on behalf of their clients charged with terrorism. On the same case, Ramsey Clark and Abdeen Jabbar made press releases on behalf of the same client before Lynn did. And after Lynn did it, in the Guantanamo lawyers, they went far beyond disobeying the SAMs, the Special Administrative Political Regulations. They defied court orders, but none of them have served a day in jail. But only Lynn Stewart, and we have to say, what is it with this Lynn Stewart that they went after? Why special, what I call it, selective prosecution of Lynn? Because Lynn is somebody special. She did say that we have the Bill of Rights in face of the Patriot Act that said we do not have the Bill of Rights. Lynn also showed that the United States government was involved in World Trade Center 1. And she had no intention, because she had no knowledge that they were involved, until she cross-examined Emont Salem in a different case, the Landmarks case. And let us remember, the defendant she was defending, Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, was never indicted for World Trade Center 1, was never charged in World Trade Center 1. Yet every time they showed the smoking towers, they superimposed the Sheikh's face, his picture. He was supposed to be evil incarnate, because they were setting up the Middle East to come under most outrageous attacks, bombings, killings, drones, shock and awe. And this was a prelude, and it had nothing to do with Lynn Stewart other than she exposed this government, other than she worked for the people who fought for justice within the government. And this is the story of Lynn Stewart. I'd like to go on forever giving you her history and fighting for education for oppressed children in the inner cities, and on and on and on. And I'm going to ask the people who say they have religion, be as religious as you profess to be. This is a crime against humanity, this government, and this is a crime against Lynn Stewart. It is a crime against the people of this nation that we allow corrupt governments such as this to operate. And we must remember that they have no conscience, because when Ramsey Clark went before the Justice Department and the president, and I had asked him how was he received, his answer was, they didn't receive me, I received them. And I asked Ramsey to explain further, and he says, what happened was, I sat and I told them where LBJ sat and where I sat. And in his voice, when he told me to go desegregate the schools of the South with the National Guard. And I, the next day after hearing that, packed Lynn's suitcase, because I felt that those gentlemen who never would have had the positions they had, had the civil rights movement not been effective, had they not gotten the right to vote, had they not pushed forward for their civil rights and their human rights. And Lynn Stewart, who was active as a political person, as an activist before she became a lawyer, and after she became a lawyer, she continued with her activism to make it possible for them to be in the position they were in. How would they dare turn down her compassionate release? Well, we know the answer to that. They turned it down, and they are the devil incarnate. And as we have to remember, what is the record of Eric Holder? Protecting organizations, companies that had union workers, unionized workers in South America killed. He was the defense attorney for these corporations. And if you're going to roll the defense lawyer over into the so-called crime, then we have to roll Eric Holder over into the crime of killing workers in South America who would ask for an increase in pay, would demand the right to be unionized, would stop American fruit from taking over their country. This is what is happening to Lynn Stewart, and I say Obama has betrayed those who in good faith listened to his words when he said he promised hope and change, and as was so well documented by Glenn Ford, false hope and short change, that these people who justifiably were fooled by Obama show their intent to not fool the rest of us by coming with me in front of the White House and building that fire that they said they were going to hold his feet to. And I'm talking about Tavis Smiley. I'm talking about Cornel West. I'm talking about Noam Chomsky. I'm talking about all of those liberals who talked about the lesser of two evils. Come with me and let's build a fire to hold his feet to in front of the White House, and I will be there from the 13th of July on. I left Washington, D.C. the day I heard that Lynn's compassionate release was turned down. She told me to come to New York and do publicity, and I will be in New York for the 1st and the 9th of July. I will be visiting Lynn from the 3rd to the 8th in Fort Worth, Texas. And when I come back, I'm going to Washington, D.C., to the White House to continue that vigil. And let us see people put their money where their mouth is. Let their feet do the walking. And come with me if they have a minute, an hour, a half a day, in front of that White House. Let's build a critical mass, because that is the only thing that will save Lynn Stewart now. They do intend to kill her. Let everybody know you heard it from me. All of their actions were intended for death for Lynn Stewart, to show everyone what will happen to people who stand up against this corrupt, unjust government. So thank you for this opportunity to bring this to people's attention, and I'm talking about religious people. I'm talking about the cases that Lynn Stewart did, and I'm remembering the case of Matthias Reyes. He's a convicted, confessed rapist who confessed to all of these things, and when he decided to talk about the five young men who were accused of the Central Park rape, and he said, they didn't do it, I did it. And when I left, there was no one in sight. And when I asked him, why was he doing it? And he said, because when I die, I want to answer to one person, that is my God. He became a Christian. He accepted God. And I say, he has more God in him than most of the religious people in America. He says when he goes, when that final day comes, his slate will be clean. Well, I'm asking those people who claim to be Christians, do something save someone's life that you know is not guilty. Lynn Stewart is not guilty, but you have to do something to save her life, like Matias Reyes did. He stood tall to say, these young men are not guilty, and I know they're not guilty. And we know Lynn Stewart is not guilty, and so we must defend her. We must do something to become the Christian that Matias Reyes became. And when Lynn sent me to see him, she didn't know what he wanted, but the other prisoners said he's in terrible trouble, because they knew that the system had set these kids up, and they didn't want to hear anybody take the fall but those they had falsely accused. And so this is the role that Lynn Stewart has played over the years. She has saved people's lives. She's called attention to situations. While the government is tired of it, they want to rule, they want to destroy people, and we cannot allow them to do it. Thank you again for this opportunity to have my voice out to the people who may come and do something. Have vigils in your city. Make your preachers and politicians stand up and say, no, we don't want Lynn Stewart dead.
Ralph, thank you so much. I just want to let you know that this program is an open platform for you. Anytime you wish to come back, you let me know, and you'll be invited back, because you and I hope many other people, are in the fight to save Lynn. We're the only ones who can do it, and I wrote an article that I put out last March. I've written at least a dozen articles on Lynn. I'm not done writing about her, but the one I wrote last March used the title that you said, Obama Wants Lynn Stewart Dead. I couldn't think of a more apt title, and that's exactly true. If they didn't want her dead, they never would have put her in prison. And if she's there, they would let her out, and they're not doing it, and they lie about it. And I agree with you. It's an outrage. It's more than an outrage. This program will mention her often. My writing will mention her often. And again, Ralph, when there's a need for you to come back, you let me know, and I'll get you on right away.
May I say that there will be a vigil in New York City July 1st at 4 p.m., Tom Paine Park, Foley Square. It is Tom Paine Park and Foley Square, the same place, right by the courthouse. And then the July 9th and at 42nd Street, it's actually 47th Street, in Times Square, we will have another vigil. They go from 4 to 9 at Tom Paine Park, and at 47th Street, I believe it's from 3 to 5 or 5:30, and I will be in Washington, D.C. at Lafayette Park the July 12th, Friday, 5:30 to 7:30. That's the same place they had the large Troy Davis rally the night he was killed. And so people get that and join me. I will appreciate it. Thanks again.
Many, many thanks, Ralph. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. Denny, you've been very, very patient. That was a very powerful statement that Ralph made. I'm sure it affected you the way it affected me. I hope it affects listeners the same way.
Denny? Yeah, I'm in shock. It's really very disturbing. Just the idea of 120 months of jail for a press release. I don't care what's in the press release. I really don't care. I don't care if you're giving so-called state secrets. I don't care what you're doing. You write a press release, you're informing the public about something, it can be challenged in court, and to receive 120 months of jail for writing a press release when you're reaching out to the public to inform them about something, I don't care what is in that press release. I don't care if it's an error, if it's a mistake. It wasn't, I know, but I don't care what it is. To do jail for a press release in America is absolutely obscene. Unbelievable. This is truly a political prisoner.
Oh, she's a political prisoner. She really is a classic
and
political prisoner.
A vicious system the U.S. is. As soon as you touch them where it really matters, where you threaten them, truly threaten them, because you're actually using the legal apparatus and all of its security to point out that the government itself was involved in a horrendous mass crime, well, now you're turning an apparatus of the system against itself. Now, that's very threatening, and that person must be eliminated and neutralized and killed, whatever it takes. You know, you cannot threaten the system in this way. You can't use the apparatus against the system. You can't use the police against the system. You can't use the courts against the system. All of these institutions are only to be used against the public, never against the government or the system itself.
Well, Denny, it's being used against you in Canada. You're free. You're not in prison, but they have certainly given you an extremely bad time. Instead of giving you the honors that you deserve, they've persecuted you ruthlessly. The same issue is for you is what targeted Lynn. Doing the right thing got Lynn targeted. Doing the right thing got you targeted.
I can feel the same mechanisms in operation in my case on a much smaller scale,
yes.
and the risk for me is not as high by any means, but it does involve prison. You know, I've been threatened by a judge of contempt of court, which is a criminal charge. He didn't follow through with it, but he could have. I could have been in jail on the spot, you know. What is happening now is that I'm rigorously using the law to point out the problems with the legal system, how lawyers break the rules, how they mistreat self-represented litigants, how when you complain about it, you get a deaf ear. The courts will not hear your complaints about lawyers misbehaving against you. They won't consider it in any way. They brush it aside, and they punish you for bringing it up. This just happened to me in a recent ruling. I was able to prove that a document put into evidence by a lawyer had been manipulated. The judge agreed that the document had been manipulated, but found it to be unimportant and punished me for suggesting that the lawyer had suggesting, I didn't even state it clearly that way, but suggesting that the lawyer had manipulated the document, where there was all this factual evidence, and the judge had found that indeed the document had been manipulated, and as soon as the judge said those words, the lawyer in question said, "I have no idea, Your Honor, how that got there. I have no idea how this happened." It's the first time that he acknowledged that there was a problem with this document, which I had been arguing through legal processes for weeks and months. So it's obscene. You try to simply get the rules to be followed. You try to have an equal playing field, and you get and in order to do that, you have to complain about some of the players. For example, there are two. Well, there's one judge that recused himself. I told that story before because I wanted him to look at the evidence that I believed that there was an appearance that he was biased, and he flipped out on me and so on. Well, I get accused of being a horrible person when I do that. He recused himself, but he claimed that it was not because of bias. He claimed it was because I was such a horrible person in bringing this up that he couldn't proceed impartially, given that I'd brought it up. I mean, this is the kind of absurdity that you have to deal with, and they attack you when all you want to do is make sure that the rules are being followed and that you're getting a fair treatment. It's absolutely obscene. It's really disturbing. And we've got to do something about this in Ontario. And I'm going to dedicate much of my energy in the coming years to trying to fix this somehow, or at the very least exposing it. It's really despicable. For a self-represented litigant to be in front of a judge is a dangerous, dangerous undertaking. So I'm in shock with the so-called justice system in Ontario. But I've got other things to tell you about.
Oh, I want to hear, Danny. I want to hear.
Well,
please go on. You feature what you have to say, because I gave the first half of the program to Ralph, and I certainly wanted you to have at least the second half. So spend the time and update listeners on what's happened to you since you were last on.
Well, something very interesting is, I mean, it's somewhat historic, I think. I've been in hearings over my dismissal. I was a full professor with tenure at the University of Ottawa. I was dismissed in 2009, and then I had to fight in order to get the university to accept to go into litigation, because they were even refusing to move in any way. They weren't doing anything. They were just sitting on their seats and not moving. So I had to threaten a lawsuit against the president before we went into litigation, and we did, and we started the hearings in 2011, and they just ended this week on June 26, 2013. We had the last hearing day. So in that period of 2 years, we had 29 hearing days. The last one has now been held. The case is closed, and now we're waiting for the arbitrator or judge to make the decision about my dismissal. And I have to tell you that this the closing arguments and the hearings and the case and everything, it was like being back in ancient Greece. It was truly a trial of Socrates. That's the impression I had. I mean, the university's arguments, they had no evidence of wrongdoing, and their arguments were basically, I mean, they had evidence, but not they had what they called evidence for the arguments they were making, but in terms of real proof and real evidence, none of the allegations were supported by hard evidence in any way. But what they were doing, instead of actually arguing the case, was it was about corrupting the youth. They were accusing me of corrupting the youth, and they would move from that charge, put in different words, to insulting important people on my blog. So here's this horrible man who suggests things to the youth, like that they should be more vigilant about their student rights, that they should be more radical in their activism against an administration that's not being reasonable, and so on. So I'm corrupting the youth on that side, and then they would go back to my blog where I'm critical of the university administrators, among others, these important people. And so, for example, they talked at great length about a blog I wrote about the university president, Alan Rock, in which I explained that he is ethically challenged. And I gave all the evidence that I could find, and there's lots of it. And it's a huge shopping list of things he's done that are in the public domain, that you can research, and you can find this, and you can write about it. And others have written the same thing. A research journalist in Ottawa actually had a title about the man, that he was ethically challenged. And so I took up that theme and then just added more data as he kept doing these things. Well, that was used as an example of why they can't possibly have me at the university, because I'm critical of the administration. And it was an insane trial. Then they went into my emails. They said I was inciting students to violence. So they went into my emails, and they got access to almost 1,700 emails, a large amount of emails from the entire period. And they went through those emails with a fine-tooth comb to look for evidence that would be relevant to me inciting violence. And they found a few emails that they said constituted such evidence. And one of them, for example, was me having a discussion with students about a demonstration they just had and suggesting that it wasn't time now to negotiate. It was time to hold firm because they had a position of strength and they should think about being more radical in their actions. And at the bottom of the email, in PS, I gave examples of what I meant by being more radical. So I mentioned things like throwing paper airplanes at the locked door of the president. I mentioned things like making a joyous bonfire in the grounds of the administration building to have a party. I mentioned things like that, and they saw my PS as, you know, giving evidence of that it wasn't time to negotiate. A good tactic, according to me at the time, was to stand firm. In fact, that was a battle that the students won, thanks to standing firm. But irrespective, here I was making these suggestions, which they said, "Oh my God, he's inciting the students to violence," as if you know, a bonfire is necessarily a dangerous thing in an open space, which is a space for meeting outside where you can do it safely, you can get a permit from the fire department, you can do it any way you want. But it was a suggestion to explain what a radical action is that attracts media attention and that puts more pressure on the administration. That was the strongest evidence they were able to find, that email with that PS in it, that I was inciting violence of students. They looked through everything. That was it. And so it was things like that, you know. There were a few other things that they said were evidence of this. For example, there was another email that they said was this terrible evidence that I was a dangerous, dangerous person. And I insisted that they produce how they had obtained that email, because I didn't have it, and it wasn't among all the emails that I had at the time. It was a very old email, and I said, "How did you get this? Show us the source." I wasn't denying that it wasn't a real email. I just wanted to be certain and see it and know the source. Well, they had to produce the source, and the source was the president of the university sending this email to some of his staff, making a joke about it. So here was this thing that was supposedly evidence of how dangerous I was, and the president was joking about it in the sense that, you know, let's use this against him, ha, 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 this kind of thing. That's how despicable they are. They lie to your face. They lie to the court's face. Here they are claiming this email, and they claim that it had been sent at a different date than it had already been sent, because they wanted to establish that it had been sent prior to my dismissal. It hadn't. It had nothing to do with my the time that I was actually in function. So they lied on the date, actually lied on the date. We were able to show this. And now, of course, I'm saying it's a lie because I think these competent lawyers do this on purpose. They're saying it's a mistake. Fine. They're saying they clarified the date later because they were forced to. Fine. But and then when we exposed where the email was from, here was the president joking about it. So it became evidence of their bad faith. And this is how the hearings went. And thank God I had an extraordinary team of lawyers that was hired by my union, and we worked closely together, and we were able to undo all of their despicable attacks against me and other students. And we were able to show that they had hired a student to spy on me and to go to great lengths, for example, to get a recording, a voice recording of something, of a talk I'd given on another campus. Well, it turns out, and then they accused me of having a recording of that talk and not wanting to produce the recording of the talk, whereas their spy had recorded it and had given copies to the dean, to the legal counsel of the university, and to the vice president academic. So they had copies of this thing. They were accusing me of having a copy of my own and not producing it. Meanwhile, we were able to uncover documents that showed that they had three copies and that they had somehow mysteriously lost all three copies and couldn't produce it. Because I was arguing that that was evidence that in that recording was evidence of the lengths they had gone to make this recording and how dishonest the spying was, well, all of a sudden they'd lost it. And then they accused me of writing a blog. I'd written a blog a long time ago that they lost things when you did access to information, freedom of information requests, that they would lose things. I would blog about this, and they would accuse me of accusing them of losing information. And here was this flagrant case where they had a voice recording in three copies in three offices of three of the highest executives in the university, and they mysteriously lost everything, even though I had asked them to preserve that specific recording if they had it. Years ago, I'd asked them to preserve it. They had been ordered to produce it by the Information and Privacy Commissioner, and they refused to acknowledge that they even had a recording at that time. They didn't put it in their index of documents that they were supposed to disclose. And now they had to admit that they had had a recording, because we uncovered emails that showed these exchanges, thanks to our vigilance. But they now had lost it. And so anytime they do this kind of stuff, what they do is they accuse you of something. So if they lost three copies of a recording at the highest offices, well, then I must have had a recording and I'm refusing to give it, and that's why they don't have it. I mean, it's just unbelievable way that they function. Now, to be fair, I had written an email a long time ago. I'd written a report about this spying, and I had mentioned that I had access to a personal recording, at the time. And then I'd forgotten about that, and so that was part of their evidence why they had made that accusation, you know. And I was saying, you know, there is this personal recording, and we're going to be able to compare it and with whatever they've obtained, and so let's see who's telling the truth. You know, I'd said something to that effect. Well, miraculously, they lost all their copies, and then I couldn't find anything that related to my comment at the time, and therefore we were stuck. You know, we didn't have a copy, but they wanted to accuse me of being the culprit in all of this, you see. So there are all these twists and turns like that. It was just quite remarkable.
Denny, when they want to get you, they contrive all kinds of ways. And if something that doesn't work quite the way they want it to, they simply go on to something else. They also have deep pockets. Money is never an object. Time isn't an object. They can go after anybody any devious way they want to. And when they want to get you, as I said, they simply won't quit until they figure out a way to do it. And at the least, they're going to give people like you misery along the way.
Well,
and that's exactly what they've done.
Here's a good example of what they did in the last few days of hearings. They said, okay, you taught a class in 2006, and there were, you know, roughly 450, 500 people in that class. Well, here you go. We found one of those former students, and you admit to knowing him, and he was picked up for a crime, but he was never charged for it. But at the time, he was picked up for an arson that had occurred in Ottawa, but then he wasn't charged. And you knew this man, and he was in your course for a semester in 2006. And they turn to the judge and say, see, that's the kind of company that he keeps. And this is the kind of tarring and mudslinging that they would do. And I would say, well, yeah, I knew him. He was in my class. He's an engineer. He's very, he was contributing in a wonderful way to the class. He's a mature student. He was helping the other students. He's a gentleman, and he's a friend of mine. And, you know, and yes, I've exchanged a few emails. And they said, aha, we want all your emails that you've ever exchanged with this man. And I said, okay, here they are. Then they went through all of those, and then they picked up some little thing. I forget what it was. What was it again? Oh, yes. At one point, he asked me for a letter of reference because he was in court on a separate charge. Then what was it? It was in relation to that. I forget. I had even forgotten what the charge was. But he was in court, and he wanted a letter of reference. And so we had exchanged a few emails about that. And there you go. Aha, you see? You knew that he was in trouble with the legal system, and you're exchanging with him and so on. I mean, this is the kind of thing that they were doing. Now, thankfully, the media followed the last hearing days, and the media wrote articles about this. And if you read between the lines, I would say that the media were ridiculed the university for suggesting this inciting violence charge against me. And so that put an end to that. They stopped doing it until the last day, where they tried it again. They tried to bring it up again. And the judge didn't let them. The judge said, no, you can't go there at the last minute. You stop presenting that evidence. You haven't put it forward in your argument. You need to shut up now. So that was a nice victory. That was a nice way to end the hearings. I'm paraphrasing all of this, and I'm sure that others will write about these events. There was a lot of people at this public hearing. The benches were filled, and there were a lot of people taking notes, and a lot of people who planned to write about it. But it was quite an event, and I'm really pleased at how it went. So that was the big thing this week. And then, of course, I had to go straight back into my other civil lawsuit that they're pursuing me with. And so I've already, since the 26th, I've already been a good half day with one of my witnesses being cross-examined, that I had to be the person, sort of the party that was representing my witness. So that was quite stressful and quite eventful. And it just goes on like that. I'm looking forward to the day when this will be over.
You don't want to spend your days in court, Denny. I wouldn't want to spend my days in court. About my only experience in a courtroom, not quite the only one, but the one that sticks in mind, related even slightly to what you're relating, the issues that Lynn Stewart went through. Once I was asked by a defense attorney to be a witness for him in a case that was so many years ago, I don't even remember who the person was and what the issues were, but I came to court. He called me to the witness stand. I was sworn in. I was asked one question. The other side objected. They dismissed me. They literally threw me off the witness stand. It wouldn't let
you
say a word.
Yeah, you mentioned that before. The system is so strange, and you never know what the tactics are. You never know what the rules are. I mean, you could be someone with a photographic memory. You could read all the court rules and all the statutes that relate to the court, and it wouldn't matter because they don't follow the rules. The first rule in the rule book is the judge gets to make up whatever rules he wants. He can change the rules. And you never know when that's going to happen. And you don't know what the practice is in terms of what they allow lawyers to do in terms of not following the rules. So you're sitting there just completely a victim. You're just observing this craziness in front of you. In fact, if you read the rules, it's even more shocking because you have this impression that they're going to actually follow these rules. And all of a sudden, the deadlines don't matter, the documents don't matter, nothing matters anymore, and they're just making it up, you know? It's an amazing thing. It's shocking.
I like to talk about rule of law principles all the time, Denny, but as you say, the judge makes it up as he or she goes along, and it's always rigged on the side of power and against ordinary people. So, you know, mere mortals come into a courtroom and you're going up against some kind of a power structure in the form of a system, an organization, a government, an individual, and people, just ordinary people, just don't have a chance in a system like that.
Even the good judges, and I mean the ones that really want to base their decisions on the facts and the evidence, and they try to, you know, confine their thinking and their analysis in terms of the rules of evidence, those ones, are suspicious of self-represented litigants. They're second-guessing the litigant, trying to avoid what they might do. And assuming that they're just playing some dirty trick of some kind, you know? So their outlook is tainted in this way, even though they would professionally like to follow these rules. So it's very difficult. I mean, this is how I understand it. Now, there's a lot of judges who simply don't care. This is my experience, not just in the judges that have dealt with my case, but also observing in court a lot and reading decisions. A lot of times, and this is no secret, lawyers will tell you this all the time, the judges will in their decisions, rewrite the facts. They'll actually have a section called facts where they'll pick the ones that they want in order to write the decision that they want to write.
Kenny, I wish we had more time. We are out of time, and I'm going to sign
off. Okay.
I would also add that there are some judges that even though they may be decent people, they know if they buck the system, it's a career ender for them. It's a dead end. And if they want to move up to a higher court, to a higher position, make more money status, they better play ball, and if they don't, they're sunk. Kenny, I look forward to getting you back. I'll shoot you an email off air. Join us again next week. I always like to remind listeners, we're on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. This is a truth hour. It's also an advocacy hour for justice. There's not enough of it around. And I certainly want this program to be a platform supporting justice. Join us next Friday. Join us always. Tell others. Spread the word. Follow PRN. Make it a regular habit.